Mijusep Ingsrilwan, where were you born, please?
I was born in Burma.
Which place?
Called Pegu, P-E-G-U.
Which year was this?
And the 21st June 1921.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father then was in the Burma Service of Engineers.
Did you go to school in Burma?
Yes. I went to the Government English High School in Memio. It was for a public school for boys of army officers, clergy, and in certain circumstances, sons of Shan chiefs. It was a predominantly European school. I then went on to Rangoon University, where I read law for 4 years until 1940. When things looked a little bit bad, sons of European officers who were abroad were being conscripted into military service. I managed to arrange for me to carry on with my law degree for another 6 months, and then I reported to Memio for what they call militia training in October 1941.
What did the militia training consist of?
Of using firearms, shouldering arms, general marching, getting us used to using the rifle, the Bren gun, and that was about all. Those are the weapons that we were equipped with in Burma at the time. I graduated early, commissioned into the Burma Rifles, and was sent down to the 9th Reinforcement Battalion of the Burma Rifles at a town called Mektila. Those who went to the Reinforcement Battalion were not posted there as such. That battalion provided for officers and men for other units. The 9th Burma Rifles was commanded by Lieutenant Colonel James Francis Haswell of the 4th Gurkha Rifles. His second in command was a Major Edward Elliott. I think that he was also a Gurkha Rifles officer. My company commander, temporary commander, was Captain Ransford from the 2nd Gurkha Rifles. I seemed to be the obvious choice to be posted to a Gurkha Rifle battalion, because I had two cousins serving in the Gurkha Rifles at the time, one in the 4th and one in the 2nd. So, within a few days of being at Mektila, some reinforcements arrived from Rangoon of 100 Gurkha soldiers for the 2nd Battalion of the 5th Royal Gurkha Rifles under an officer called Captain Robin Parry. I was then delegated to accompany Parry to join the 2nd and 5th Royal Gurkha Rifles. However, things took a bit of a change, and in about 24 hours' time, my orders were hastened. I left Parry, and I was told to go and report to the battalion, which was then at the place called Abaing, A-B-A-I-N-G, on the Pegu to Malmain Railway. So I took off from Mektila, and it must have been about 4 days later that I managed to locate the battalion. Reported to Colonel Cameron, Ronnie Cameron, who was the commanding officer, who, in a broad way, was a kinsman of mine. And his brother, that was my aunt. And I think he purposely asked me. Having got to Cameron, I was told that it was very urgent that I should report to Brigade Headquarters, 48th Brigade Headquarters, under Brigadier Hugh Jones, in a double barrel name, because my youth would be more important there. So I then went on to a place called Chaito, where I believe the brigade was harbored. From 48th Brigade, I was then told to report to Headquarters 17 Indian Division, The GOC was Major General Jackie Smythe, Victoria Cross. I reported to a Colonel Simpson, who was the GSO1. I asked them what I should do there, because initially I was just sent as a battalion intelligence officer, and he said, well, we are a great shortage of Burmese speakers, people we can trust. We know that the Japs have crossed the Salween after taking Maw Ning, but we know nothing about their numbers, their divisional signs, or anything like that. We understand that there's going to be a seaborne landing at a place called Bilin. Now, the Bilin River flowed into the Indian Ocean, as did the Salween and as did the Satang further west. I was asked to patrol that area of the Bilin by picking up stragglers from the 3rd Burma Rifles, some from the military police at Balmain, and I generally collected about a couple of platoon strength of these men who had managed to get away from the Japanese. I then carried out some patrols.
Was it easy to find these people?
Well, there were milling around. They were with the different brigades. They were in Fatone. There was an officer who pointed them out to me, a Major Appleby. They all seemed to be assembled. There was an assembly point for all those who managed to escape from Maumain, and they became sort of virtual military refugees in Fatone, which was the 17th Div headquarters. So I picked up the sort of men I wanted, and I formed a reconnaissance platoon.
So you were trying to monitor Japanese movements?
In a very difficult way, because I had no means of communications other than use the GPO telephone, which seemed to be standard with 17 Div. The GOC ringing his brigade commanders by the use of the GPO telephone, which we later discovered the Japs had tapped, and they knew all our movements. I went down to the Bilin estuary. I went to a little village called Wetho there, which was a fishing village, had a look at the surroundings. It was absolute mangrove swamp. It was mud deep, no, except for the odd fishing canoe. Nothing could have been brought up to the estuary there. There was a little inlet where the Bilin River went into the Indian Ocean, or the Bay of Martaban, they call it. And I reported back, not through to brigade headquarters. I managed to see the colonel of the 412 Frontier Horse Regiment, Colonel Donnie Edwards. And I said, look, there's no, whatever rumors there might be around, there's no Jap movement there. The movement is certainly coming from the east, and it's coming from Martaban, where I believe the Jap 33 Div has crossed the Salween, and they're making towards the Satang Bridge. And the idea is that they've got three regiments, the 213, 214, and 215 Japanese regiments, who are being used in the usual tactics of trying to encircle us. I suggested that they should move away from the Bilin, because there was a very wide front to cover. There was no way of communicating rapidly, because I didn't have a WT set. I was only relying on the GPO telephone. It was very difficult for me to move with my men from A to B. I mean, going 10 miles took us almost all day. Eventually, I managed to get a whole lot of bicycles. And like the Japanese, we became mobile on bicycles. Now, in that whole situation, I was informed by Colonel Simpson from 17 Div that there was a mounted platoon of Burma Frontier Force. The Burma Frontier Force was broken up into columns, and there was column 1 to column 9, and they were known as FF. Now, there was a mounted infantry platoon of FF2, which came under the command of a chap called Major Jeff Love. They were down in Tarasem. Poor Jeff Love, in a mistake of orders, was ambushed by the Japs and he was killed. There was a road from southern Burma thing, right up through Mergweed to Boy to Balmain, where some of these fellows managed to escape, mainly Mendy Gurkhas, plus this mounted platoon. The brigade commander from 46th Brigade, a chap called Roger Eakin, who I found very, very good, very receptive to any information you gave him. I couldn't get in touch with my brigade because they were on the western side of the bridge. But I said that there was one Japanese regiment that was hell-bent on bypassing the brigade perimeter, going through this dense forest, which we all seemed to avoid, and they were heading straight for the bridge. They were going to take over the bridgehead. And my advice was to move the brigade back as quickly as possible to the bridgehead, so that we only had a company of 3rd Burma Rifles, and I think one company of King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry at the bridge. He was told that it would have been impossible for the Japs to cut round us through this dense forest. And I said, oh, silly. They've been coming through from Siam, through dense forests. Those things don't worry them at all. Anyway, he got this information through to Div. Div then assured him that there was a mounted reconnaissance platoon consisting of two British officers and Sikh horsemen from FF2 who were covering that northern area. Well, as it transpired later, the two officers concerned, one chap called Stevenson, another chap called Edwards, they were both second lieutenants. They did bump into the Japs. But as soon as many shots were fired in anger, Edwards and Stevenson got their men, went up north, crossed the river through a ford, and they disappeared for good and never saw them again. So, as far as 17 Div, reconnaissance for that northern area, it was nil. Japs bypassed them, went through the forest. Of course, they had a pincer movement, and they came down to the bridgehead from the north. 214th Regiment, which was coming through Stone and Chaitel, almost south, wedged in between 46 and another brigade, 16th Brigade, and they got to near the bridgehead before there was a cramp there. The 3rd Regiment, the 214th, went along the riverbank, the Satang riverbank, and of course they reinforced the other two regiments up there, and that's where the catastrophe started. I was then thought very unfortunate to be left behind this whole lot that were going forward. But I went to Beelin town and I needed money to buy supplies for several of the troops, Indian troops, British troops who were there. They didn't know how to get any food other than what they had in bully beef tins and what have you. Couldn't get anything fresh. So I then became a sort of a loose catering officer. So I went to the treasury officer at Beelin and I drew 5,000 rupees. All very well. I put my signature to the receipt, fully believing that we would go back and his accounts would be put in order. On the 21st of February, I got a little note when I was at this Webio village from a university friend of mine to say that he was in the Japanese trained British Defense Army and so were a few others, and he would like to meet me. So I said, yes. He said he would come in civilian clothes, unarmed, by himself, to show his bona fides, and he would go to the village headman's house where I should meet him, and we arranged a meeting for 2 o'clock, I remember, on that particular day. I wasn't, of course, in the headman's house. I was a good distance away watching things. And I had 3 Gurkhas with me, and of course this chap, I saw several people walk into the headman's house, and we surrounded it, and there was my old friend. I said, what are you doing in the Japanese? He said, well, I'm in the Burma Defense Army. I said, yes, I didn't wonder that, because he was a terrible nationalist, agitator, students' unions a lot. But he was a very good friend of mine. And we had all sorts of arguments at university. I hated the students' union. I wouldn't join them. But he said, Carlyle, you are being totally outnumbered. Now, for God's sake, get word back to your top people that the Japs are not going to come and attack you frontally. They're going to get around you. This is the tactics they've employed all the way through. Roadblocks and pincer movements. And he said, in fact, at this particular moment, 215 Japanese regiments. It was through him that I got the divisional number and the regimental numbers of these three regiments. They're going to do an encircling movement from the north through the teak forests, coming through into the bridgehead from the north. They're going to attack from the north. They're also going to secure the ferry, which is slightly north of the bridge. So I said, what that ferry constitutes if we don't have to use the bridge? And he said, well, it's a very seldom used ferry, but it does take lorries and the odd car and bullock carts and passengers across. It's a platform that is towed by a small launch. I said, are there any other ferries? And he said, yes, there's a ferry down at the village called Mokumi. It's a fishing village at the mouth of the river, Satang River. That is fordable at low tide, and you get across to another fishing village called Chuede. Now, he said, if I were you, I wouldn't go and get involved in the bridgehead there. Do as much as you can, but that's where you want to cross. It's Mount South. So I said, what are you telling me all this about? It was then that he said, well, we took the disillusion of the Japs now. We've been with them for some time. I said, when did you join them? He said, well, you might have known that I went to Japan ostensibly in 1940 for further study. He said, yes, further military studies. I went with the 30 heroes. I said, what rank are you now? And he said, I'm only a lieutenant. He said, I'm not the original 30.
Who were the 30 heroes?
Well, they were the Aung San. They all sort of took on funny names, you know. And he said, your mutually good friend, who now calls himself Boya Nang, he was very friendly with me. I was quite a famous footballer at university. I played for the university team, and I scored goals, and we had all that nonsense. I boxed a lot for the university. I ended up as the unbeaten heavyweight champion. I made it a point, it was my father's pushing, that when I went and I was in hall at university, there were two halls separated for Europeans and Eurasians. I didn't go to either. I went into a purely Burmese hall because my father said, you go to college, you want to meet the people there, and that's the best way you can do it. Because, you see, we sons of British officers who were either in the civil service or not were always being groomed for future government service in Burma. And they said, you learn Burmese properly, you'll understand the people properly. So I was sort of sore thumb in this whole hall, but I became very good friends with all of them, even though I irritated them by trying to stop strikes and God knows what else. So at least that friendship paid off when I was mixed up in this sort of situation.
Why had you disliked the student union so much?
Well, I think one was, you see, when your father is an imperial officer and you are imbued, I mean, I didn't need to be taught. The British Empire was everything for me. What on earth are you fellas wanting to start strikes and student unions? You fellas would never, well, we want to get independent. You would never get independence. What are you talking about? You fellas are too premature, immature, and all that. And I used to take a little bit of a delight, actually, in thwarting them and everything they did. But they very, very generously sort of accepted me. In actual fact, there were situations when the lady students were drawn into the strike. And to get from my hostel hall to my lecture class, I had to go over several bodies. that were draped in front of the gates. And irritated them by going over them and coming back again and going over them and coming back again on one particular date when the strike was at its height. And I was sent threats to say, look, you try this one again, you've had it. My friends who were students, members of the student union in my hall, sent a note to these people saying, you touch him, you're going to be in trouble. And that's the sort of charmed life I had. Now, when I said, you're disillusioned about the holiday, what makes you disillusioned? He said, well, to start off with, they committed a lot of atrocities against the Siamese. And he said, when we took Mergui and Tavoy, he said, they shot and killed people out of hand. He said, we didn't expect that sort of thing. We thought that by joining up with the Japanese, they were fellow Asians, they would be much more sympathetic to us as other Asians. But it seems to me that they seem to have a much more stuck-up attitude than the British ever had. There doesn't seem to be any sympathy there at all. I said, surely there must have been. There are one or two Japanese or something. He said, oh yes, there are one or two. He said, those that are sympathetic to us are those fellows that came in as spies years and years before, pretended to be dentists, photographers, but they were Japanese intelligence officers. They were in Burma so long that they got to know the Burmese. And he said, we have one chap, Colonel, who was a Haito or something photographer. He turns out to be Colonel Suzuki, chief of intelligence. And he said, he's the sort of chap that one could talk to. Because he said, we were not used to being driven hard like the Japanese. He said, when they left Siam, Ratnaburi, we had to go through very, very heavy jungle. And he said, we had to manhandle tank parts a lot. He said, you know, we were not trained to march hundreds of miles, whereas these fellows were. They had years and years of fighting in the jungles against the Chinese and people like that. So if we in any way failed to do something, they jumped on very hard on the DDA. Plus the fact that he said, you remember Aung San? I said, yes. Well, he said, Aung San murdered a headman just outside the tour. He was a Muslim headman. Apparently, he passed some information over to the British, and Aung San personally benefited him. Now, this came up after the war when it was suggested that Aung San should be arrested for the man's murder. But politics being such then, he was destined to be the future leader of Burma, so they quietly forgot it. The Indian Muslim Congress took this thing up in 1945, but they were soon shot down as not being very convenient charging this man. And he said, these are the sort of things that are happening. They also expected us to execute people out of hand. So I said, how are you going to carry on then, Edward? And he said, I don't know. Do you think I should come over to the British? I said, no. It's too early for you to come, for heaven's sake. What's going to happen to your family and people like that? You're going to be treated as a deserter. I said, I'll tell you what, keep in touch. Now, when they blew the bridge at 5:30 that morning, I was below the rubber plantations, Boyaji plantations, not very far from the fishing village, Mokumi. I had no idea that the bridge was going to be blown or anything like that. I know that we're having trouble getting transport across the bridge because apparently at the last minute, it was only a railway bridge, you see, with a little path, footpath, to the side of it. The very last minute, I think it was January, the army decided to plank it so you could take motor transport across. And apparently the work was half done and a damn lorry got stuck in the middle. So that delayed the movement of transport. It was going all right because 48 Brigade managed to get across. Certain other elements managed to get across. A third of the division managed to get across. The others were stuck because the Japs had done a pincer movement and they were shelling this bridgehead on the eastern bank of the Satang River. Starting, that was Mokpalin Station that started off the train over the bridge. Anyway, I heard the explosion. I think I thought, oh boy, that must be. The RAF used to come and machine gun us and bomb us, including the Japanese. The RAF did a lot of damage there. I later found out that they were told that anybody in the river or anybody along the bank on the eastern side were all Japanese. So the poor chaps who were trying to swim the river with machine guns in the water, they lost quite a lot of what killed them. And in addition to the Jero fighters coming over, the RAF very kindly destroyed the small ferry launch down at Mokumi and the south there. But fortunately, through Eddie, word was sent to me not to cross the river till it was slack time, where you only had about 600 yards to swim across. But the tide was quite swift there, because quite naturally the river narrowed, really. And we had a lot of sandbanks to walk across. So I decided, you know, there were a whole lot of people mixed up. I wasn't in charge at all. I was just an officer there trying to help Gurkhas from the 7th Gurkha, 3rd, 7th, 1st, 7th. And there were chaps from the 9th Jat Regiment, 10th Baluch. We had the 7th Rajputs. We had Coilies. We had Duke of Wellington's. You name them. Not that they'd come down towards the ferry, but these fellows had got into the river short of the bridge, where it was very fast flowing, and tried to get across. And of course, they would be washed down. And as the tide was coming out, they couldn't make the other side. They were coming back here again. When I got to Mokumi and I went down to the foreshore, I thought there would be about only about 30 of us. There were hundreds of them. So there were several officers from the Dukes, from one particular chap, he should have been decorated, a chap called Meta Raman. He was the adjutant of the 412 Pontefract Regiment. He did a lot of very good work. And we grouped them. Now, what appalled me was the Dukes came in, I think it was on the 16th of February, and I met saw several of the Dukes. They all came in, stark uniforms. They looked at us as though we were sort of what the cat brought home, you know. We were all in, well, I wasn't in rags anyway, but a lot of the troops were in rags. The Coilies particularly. No shoes in some cases. Some had no hats. They were trained to a place called Chaito, which was nearly 30 miles away from the bridge. Orders were suddenly changed, and they were told to march back to the bridge. Now, in that time, I don't think they went into action at all. I stand corrected. But by the time they got back to the bridge, by the time they came down to the ferry south, they had no clothes, all their khaki had disappeared, no hats, no firearms, no shoes. I remember telling these chaps,